All right, let's get going and find out what's happening with the worldwide crisis that appears to be on the doorstep in the next month or so of getting worse with the arrival of flu season. Stories today, Georgia, Texas, Florida lead the country in coronavirus cases per capita, even though there's supposedly an overall decline over the past few weeks. The new cases, though, are still burgeoning. Nothing new there. A new report says flying on airplanes is probably posing a relatively small risk of becoming infected. I haven't read the story yet. It's a Fox story. One case of coronavirus has been tested and allegedly established at Sturgis, the big motorcycle rally. A couple hundred thousand people there having a good time. And so one case brought out a warning from the state health director. All right. Well, that's just a few things. Hey, let me look at this story about the airplane again here real quick. A lot of people fly, and they say that they're really not doing much aboard these planes to separate people. And you've seen stories of people who were refuseniks being asked to leave the airplanes and so forth. The odds of catching novel coronavirus on an airplane with infected passengers appear to be relatively small, though still possible, according to a new report from Germany, where researchers told of the health outcomes for more than 100 passengers on a flight in a report recently published in the journal JAMA, Network Open, it's called. The German researchers reported that the health status of 102 passengers who boarded a Boeing 737 flight in Tel Aviv, Israel on March 9, according to the study, the flight just over 4.5 hours was going to Frankfurt, blah, blah, blah. And they had very little spread. This is in March, though. This is before the Italian strain was so thoroughly ensconced. So I wouldn't want to take this report to the bank. Little based on older data, as they say. That's 5 months, 4 months almost. Henry, welcome back. How are you tonight?
Well, Jeff, it's good to be back. It's been another busy day. A lot of repeats, actually. The numbers today are almost identical to the numbers yesterday as far as the deaths were concerned. Uh-huh. The cases were up a little bit. There was a big jump reported in Missouri. I don't know if that's real or not. So, you know, that brought the total number of cases over 52,000. It might be a little bit lower than that if that jump in Missouri is an error. But the deaths were, so far there's 1,341 today versus 1,304 yesterday, so a little bit higher today. And as you mentioned with the per capita, the deaths are still in the same state. Texas was number one today with 309 deaths, so it's mm-hmm. still going strong there. Florida reported 174, California reported 163, and Arizona, which is kind of choppy, that was one that Trump had said was looking good, they had 105 deaths today. So the deaths are, still quite high in all four of those states. Those were the four states that were reporting the highest numbers of deaths. Georgia's trailing them a little bit, but they had 55 deaths today. So they were, number five out of all the state's reporting today. So it does look like the virus itself is pretty steady as far as the reporting is concerned. The cases are more in the 50,000 range. They've gotten up to about 60,000. It's still not clear exactly what that's from. I mean, Florida seems to be showing a drop, but Florida is has cut back on testing. They only reported 4,000 cases today. They had been above 10,000, and they had settled in around 8,000 or 9,000. And in recent days, they reported 4,000 a day, 3,800 yesterday. And the tests are down. So it's not clear. They had a bunch of issues there, with the tornado coming through. They shut down a bunch of centers. They had a big backlog, and, that may have discouraged people from getting tested. And, it's not clear why the testing is down so dramatically. It's not surprising that the testing goes down dramatically. The confirmed cases is going to be lower. And so that's kind of skewing the data down a little bit. And, California is also a little bit lower. There are 6,700 cases today. And Texas is a little bit lower than its peak. It's around 7,000. Mm-hmm. But, one of the keys is the deaths. And the deaths have crept back above 1,000 a day. Lately has been 1,300. It does get higher during the week compared to the weekend. And the other thing that's starting to show up more is what's going on with the schools. It looks like the number of confirmed cases at UNC in Chapel Hill was well over 100, and the same thing happened in Notre Dame. So UNC ended up sending all the students home and essentially said they're not going to have any in-class instruction. Notre Dame shut down in-class instruction for 2 weeks, and then they're going to reassess the situation. Now Michigan State seems to have some significant outbreaks, and they're expressing some concern as to what's going on there. And this is simply going to continue, that there's way too much virus around with 50,000 cases in the U.S. And some of these states, I've mentioned are very high in the number of cases as well as the number of deaths. The deaths are showing up because they've had this high number of cases for a while now. And some of these same states are insisting that all the schools hold in-class sessions. And I think, well, not necessarily California, but I think that most of these states in the South, Florida, Georgia, Texas, are all kind of in the optional category. So they encourage students to wear masks, but they don't make that mandatory. So if they're, just going to encourage it and not have a high percentage of the students wearing the masks, the virus is going to spread, and it's going to spread just going to class in the hallways, because the hallways are always crowded between classes. And then the students are going to have various parties, et cetera. So, it's still on track for there being a fairly major increase in cases in the upcoming weeks. Different school districts further north are getting ready to open up. Here, my boots on the ground in Fox Chapel had a big sign yesterday. No, I think it was this morning. It said freshman orientation. So they're clearly going ahead, and the freshmen are coming to class to get oriented, to get ready for the
Well, masks season. Optional in your area, or are they going to force them?
No, they signs all over the place that says, wear a mask and keep 6 feet distance. So they pretty much are, it's not optional at the, like I said, they were doing, physicals. I saw them lined up for the physical. When they were doing that, they weren't 6 feet apart, but I didn't see anybody that didn't have a mask. So everybody has a mask if they're going into class. On the other hand, if they're, playing football in the preseason, the only ones wearing masks are the coaches. The coaches wear masks, but none of the players are wearing masks. And that's not a big surprise for football in particular. But that's the reason that I just don't see this lasting any length of time, because the contact sports are not going to have masks, and they're going to have contact, and they're going to be breathing hard, especially football, and that virus is going to spread, and then they're going to have issues with trying to get games in by having too many football players infected, and then they're going to infect classmates. And that's why I think the sports is going to cause a problem. Now, today, Allegheny County, which is where Pittsburgh is, actually had the lowest number of cases in quite some time. The number was, 27 in the entire county, which is low. I mean, they usually have had at least 100 cases a day, and, had gotten as high as 150, 200 cases. And today there were only 27. So that was the lowest it's been in a very long time. I don't know if it was a fluke or what. It's the middle of the week, so I'm not sure why it was as low as it was today. But I don't think it'll last. I think that the in this school district and the other school districts, it's probably more of an issue of how much they're actually testing as opposed to
this whole pandemic is the fault. Henry, the whole pandemic is the fault of testing. If they just had not done this stupid testing, you wouldn't be on the air right now. You'd be home having fun. That's right.
Well, the concern is that the testing will go down. I mean, to really monitor and understand how much virus there is, as the virus levels do go down, to do contact tracing and try to control it, you actually do need to test. Now, there's a rapid test that is
the saliva test
coming online, right? It's a saliva test. Exactly how quickly that can roll out. I mean, one of the advantages of the saliva test is you don't need some of these specific utensils or transport media. I mean, for the nasal swabs, you need you need the swab, you need test tubes to put the swab into, along with transport media to kind of keep the cells happy while they're being transported. With saliva, you're really not, you just collect the saliva sample and do the DNA extraction. Or RNA extraction or amplification right in the material. So it's not something that you're going to be in short supply because everybody's using it. And so it should be easier that way. And it's a rapid test. So you actually do it at the point of collection. So you don't need this transport medium to kind of keep things happy until it gets to the lab.
Who figured this test out?
It's not that unusual. You know, that basically, it's really these rapid tests. I think, I'm not sure. I think they may be actually looking at the protein levels. So they really just need a good, like, monoclonal antibody that'll react with the viral protein, and then they could do, you know, just kind of like a pregnancy test or a rapid flu test. I mean, those are all tests that are designed to give a result in a matter of minutes, and they basically are looking at the protein. Usually, the problem with the rapid test is the sensitivity, like the flu test. The rapid test was popular because you got the results in, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. You could do it right in the doctor's office. You didn't have to, it was a pretty straightforward test. The problem is its sensitivity was only about 60-70%. So you'd have about a third of the cases that were negative, even though the virus was there. So it had to be at a high enough level to kind of pick it up. It's the type of test that you can run, you know, almost daily. And I think the NBA was using this test, and that seemed to be working well enough to kind of keep the teams intact, and the season seems to be going forward. I mean, they're all kind of in a bubble, and they're limiting the contact with people outside of the team, but they're testing regularly, and outward appearances look like they're able to identify people that are infected at a high enough frequency that they can isolate them and keep the virus somewhat under control and get the season in, or at least so far they've got a good portion of the season in. I'm not sure how many games they played, but it seems that they're still on track. And so if that became widely available, that might help with the schools, you know. But it's a little bit of apples to oranges, because with the basketball teams, they've got them under this bubble, so to speak. So, you know, they're basically playing basketball and they're coming into contact with other players, but they're not really coming into a lot of contact with the rest of the population. And therefore, they're kind of keeping the virus under control. With schools, that's not going to happen. That essentially, the students are coming and going. You know, they go home. They can do whatever on weekends and after school. And the potential for spread is higher. And actually, WHO just came out with a warning that that most of the virus that's being transmitted right now is being transmitted by younger people. And so, you know, this idea that the students can't transmit the virus, or, well, you know, they use the data that not that many younger people are dying, although a fair number can still go into the hospital. But they were using that as an argument that, at least Trump was, that you don't really have to worry about them at school because very few of them end up dying. Ignores the fact that one of the concerns in the schools isn't so much that most of the students are going to die, it's that the students are going to spread the virus to other students, and then they're going to spread it to, you know, faculty and staff at the schools, and the faculty and staff that are going to end up dying. or going into the hospital, and then they're going to bring it home, and it's going to be the parents and the grandparents that are going to end up getting sick and dying. And so the schools are still a major concern. Some of the teachers are talking about going out on strike if they, you know, if they insist that they, you know, go to class. Others are actually retiring and figure that the risk isn't worth it to themselves or to their family members. A lot of the teachers are going to be, you know, older and more likely to have underlying conditions. It doesn't really interfere with them, you know, actually teaching or doing their jobs, but it's a risk factor that if they get infected, you know, it could have severe consequences for themselves or their spouses or their parents, you know, depending upon what the living situation is. So the schools are still going to be the biggest deal. And you know, there have been those initial reports down in Georgia with school closings. And there is a concern that there's these, you know, funny results that are still not clear, like Florida. It's not clear, you know, why there's less testing and whether the testing is due to the fact that it was so difficult to get test results, people gave up on it, or whether there's less testing because enough people, for whatever reason, are convinced that, well, maybe it's not that big a deal. And my guess is that's all going to change in the next several weeks because the number of cases will start to go up. There'll be a lot of publicity about it. And then teachers will end up in the hospital, and students will hear about these teachers, and it wasn't that they're on strike, and it wasn't that they, you know, tested positive and they're under quarantine. It was because they not only tested positive, but they have a serious case, and they ended up being hospitalized. And then they'll start hearing about the teachers or the cafeteria workers or the bus drivers, and that's another area. I mean, a lot of the bus drivers are older. There's people that are basically, you know, they haven't always been a bus driver and are kind of doing that.
No, that's right. A lot of 60-year-old bus drivers.
Right. Sure. And so they obviously get exposed, you know, to a lot of students if they're basically driving the bus all day. And, you know, they have different groups, you know, age groups. And so they can be picking everybody up to take to school and then picking everybody up to take them home and end up getting a lot of contact with a lot of different students with, you know, multiple routes going and coming. And that'll create problems. So it's kind of a steady type of a thing as far as the number of cases right now. But it's a little bit too early to see the effects of going back to school. And it was, you know, if you recall, I've mentioned this before, but it's probably worth repeating because it's timely, that with swine flu, that's essentially what happened. You started to see it in different schools in the South that opened up first, and then it became more common in the North, and then it really took off, at least in the North, right around here. It really took off about 6 weeks into the school year, that the kids were coughing, but they weren't really that sick at the beginning of school. But then 6 weeks later, there was a high level of absenteeism, and there were difficulties, you know, keeping things rolling because the teachers had a similar absenteeism rate. And, of course, with the swine flu, you know, I mentioned this before, it pretty much replaced the seasonal flu. And so the overall number of...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's totally gone. I mean, the H1N1 is gone. There's no seasonal H1N1. It's been totally replaced by the swine flu. And the swine flu was a pandemic, so it didn't, you know, disappear in April. It didn't disappear, period. It's really all over the place. It not only went to humans all over the place, it went to swine all over the place.
Yeah.
So swine got infected with this, you know, kind of weird combination that caused the swine flu. That particular combination had not been reported on. There's been triple reassortants that have been reported, but not.
Well, speaking of swine, Henry, hold on. This year in China, some months ago, we had not just China, but we had an outbreak of a swine virus, which I think led to the deaths, the culling of 500 million pigs, some enormous amount of pigs. Huge. What was that?
Right, but that wasn't a coronavirus or
no, but it was a swine flu again, right? A variant?
No,
do we know? I don't know what
flu.
It was.
No, it was it was another virus that typically infect swine, but it wasn't influenza, and it wasn't coronavirus. I mean, there is a coronavirus that infects swine, but that's not what caused the outbreak in China. But actually,
they call it
G4
swine flu viruses. CDC takes action. This is just in July to prepare against G4 swine flu. Yeah.
Right, that's not the big outbreak. That one is an example of swine flu, and it's a combination. And they saw a few people that had the virus, so it jumped from swine to
H1N1,
which swine flu typically does, right? And it was a constellation that they were concerned about because they had a few human cases, but they didn't have an inordinate number of human cases. It was the viruses in the swine. And the swine flu is common in swine. I mean, what was uncommon was that the virus that was in swine jumped to humans and it transmitted easily in humans. And then became established, and the one that caused the pandemic in 2009 was some of the gene segments matched North American, and some of the gene segments matched Eurasian, and that was an unusual combination, and that's the combination that led to the. To the 2009 pandemic, and that's the version that's currently in humans, and you know, ever since 2009, and that's the example. That's the most recent influenza pandemic in humans, and it first appeared in. The spring of 2009, and then it was much worse in the fall of 2009. And in the fall, it outcompeted not only seasonal H1N1, but actually seasonal H3N2. So everything that was, all the influenza A that was circulating in the fall of 2009 was the swine H1N1. So it jumped species, got into humans, and became very widespread and very dominant. And so, you know, getting back to the reporting and the testing, you know, there is a concern that, you know, as you said, and I said many, many times, that the best way to control, you know, lab-confirmed viral diseases is to simply not test. And so, like I say, the numbers are down in Florida, but the testing is down in Florida, and it's not really clear that there's been that much of a reduction. The deaths are not down, but the deaths are trailing indicators. So the deaths aren't going to be down for a while because of the number of cases. So there is the concern that it's going to be more of a reporting issue, and that as things get worse, the ability of the general public to know where the virus is and isn't may end up being affected by exactly how much testing is ongoing. So, if this saliva test gets widespread, then a reduction in testing is not likely, because that test is supposed to be relatively cost effective. I think it's like $10 or something like that,
right.
And technically they could do it for less than that if they wanted. I mean, it's not that these reagents cost that much, and if all you have to do is spit in a tube, then it's fairly easy to collect the samples, and then you just pop it into the machine, and you get a result within minutes. Maybe it'll take a half an hour or something, but you can get tested right in the doctor's office, and they can.
Well, the NBA, we talked about the NBA. And the NBA Players Association and one big pharma company got together and apparently brought this test into existence. That was what they wanted to do so they could keep playing.
Right.
They needed it.
Yeah. Well, I think they had the test. They just needed a population to prove that it worked. So that's what the combination was. I think the test existed, but they needed a population that they could basically apply it to a large enough number that they could show that, they could identify who really had it, and they could identify those people and quarantine them, and that way they could control the spread of the virus. And that's what the whole idea of doing the testing is, so that if you catch it when the level's low enough, you can do something about it. So, there is, it's still a little bit fuzzy as to how the reporting of the pandemic's going to go forward. I mean, there's no real plan. I mean, there's
nothing new there.
Waiting for vaccines. The vaccines are, the ones that are out front require two shots, and so they're really not going to have results from the vaccine.
We have proof. We know that there are compounds that will work to slow, if not stop, viral replication. Acyclovir is the most well known. Right, Zovirax is the brand name. It's an antiviral. It's not designed to work on coronavirus. It's designed to work on human herpes virus, HHV. There's six different groups. All right, so what do we have here to stop us from looking?
DNA viruses. So.
Okay, all right. So what do we have that we might think about trying to apply to a coronavirus that would be like an acyclovir, something like that?
Well, there's a bunch of antivirals that are in clinical trials right now. The idea is that remdesivir works. So the idea was that you would get a bunch of different antivirals that attack the virus at different points. That the remdesivir really is attacks the nucleic acid, that it basically is a nucleotide analog, and so when that gets incorporated into the virus, it terminates the replication. So to grow, it has to copy its genetic information, and when this drug comes in, it goes in as one of the nucleotides, and then it can't extended chain. So it basically, once that gets in there, it can't keep growing, and therefore it can't copy its genetic information. So that inhibits the ability of the virus to copy the RNA. And then there's protease inhibitors that basically target proteases that are used by the virus to process the polyprotein. That typically what happens is the reading frame codes a long peptide which has got a bunch of different proteins in it, and a protease has to chop it up into this pieces, and so it's enzymatically active after it gets cleaved. And if you have a drug that inhibits that protease, so the protease can't go and process the polyprotein into its component parts, then that will block the ability of the virus to function. And so the idea is somewhat like with HIV, that you basically target the virus at different points in its life cycle, and you hit all of them at the same time. And that makes it very difficult for resistance to take hold, because even if there's resistance to one of the drugs, the other drugs, there's a sufficient number of other attacks by other drugs that the virus basically can't replicate. And then the patient recovers because there's not that much virus going on. And so these other drugs are in clinical trials. It's just that it takes a while to actually get them approved, and that's another approach, that there'll be a cocktail of various antivirals. Most of these are small molecules that are relatively cheap as far as the manufacturer is concerned. And it's just chemicals off the shelf so that they can be manufactured fairly easily. Now some of it's a complex process. And that's the case of remdesivir, that there's a little bit of a issue as far as scale-up's concerned, because they have to go through a bunch of different chemical reactions to actually get the final product out. And so that's causing some issues, because remdesivir is a U.S. drug maker, and they're pretty much using it in the U.S., but they don't have that much of it, so they're not giving it to any other countries. And so the other countries aren't real happy that there's a compound that's out there, but they can't use it because there's not enough of it. So that is a potential problem with the antivirals, is it kind of depends exactly what that antiviral is and what the manufacturer purification process is. And, you know, these chemical reactions take chemicals off the shelf, but, you know, they have to go through a series of steps to get the drug to the right purity level and have the right components, the different active groups that they put on the drug, so that it behaves the way the final product is supposed to behave. And each one of these processes takes time, and there's a purification process, and that reduces the yield. And it can be limiting. It's not that easy to scale up, especially when you've got, you know, literally millions of cases worldwide. And so to get that out to, you know, to treat millions of cases is a scale up issue. So there are antivirals out there, and they are in clinical trials. There's literally, I think there's something like 250 clinical trials between vaccines and antivirals. And so there's a lot in the pipeline. I mean, that's one of the pluses and minuses. I mean, the plus is that pharmaceutical companies have been working on this for different viral diseases. You know, HIV is one example where that's really a retrovirus. That's an RNA virus with a DNA intermediate. So actually the RNA gets copied to DNA, and the DNA can kind of hide away in the DNA of the host and integrate into there and just mix in with the host DNA and then get activated at a given time. And when it isn't activated, there's no real target. It's just the genes in with the host genes with DNA, and
okay.
Each time the cells divide, they copy
right.
it. So
250 trials for antivirals and vaccines. If somebody were to come up with an antiviral that just suppressed this virus to the extent that the body could knock it down and take control of it, that would be a pretty big victory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the problem with a single antiviral is the virus develops resistance. Yeah, I mean, the AZT is an example that the initial treatments for HIV kind of work initially, but then a mutant arises that is mm-hmm. resistant to that one particular drug, and then that gives it an advantage, and pretty soon the only thing that's circulating is a mutant, and the drug doesn't work anymore. So you have to worry about resistance, and that's why a cocktail is preferred. So instead of having a single drug that mm-hmm. the virus can mutate away from, you have three or four drugs
keep it too
that are
busy.
Given simultaneously.
I got it. Yeah.
And yeah, so if it gets resistance to one, it can't really grow anyway, because the other three drugs that are there end up knocking out the virus, and so it doesn't become dominant, because it really would need to develop resistance to all four drugs to take off. And
right.
so that's why the cocktails are more effective. But I mean, because the remdesivir works to a degree, it's a little bit difficult to scale. And there is a concern that if that's used all by itself, that mm-hmm. pretty soon there'll be a coronavirus is circulating that's resistant to the remdesivir. It doesn't incorporate that nucleotide anymore. It basically has a polymerase that kind of excludes that, and therefore it doesn't recognize it and doesn't put it into the RNA, and therefore there's no chain termination, and the virus just goes on and merely uses, you know, the natural nucleotide that it uses all the time, and it's able to go ahead and grow. So those are things that are, you know, I mean, that's why they have all these trials, and that's why the expertise is going to be useful in the long run. But it's a matter of proving how well it works, and then if you want to use a couple in combinations, it's
right.
Useful to show that you don't develop resistance if you have, you know, three of them or something, and these are the three that work well. And so that's all, you know, it takes time to
right.
to
okay.
run those
another
trials
another question
to find
here.
Out how they work.
You talk to people a lot, all over the world, and have since this thing began. What are you hearing from your colleagues and associates in this field of virology and science? What are they saying? What are they putting their money on?
Well, they're essentially saying that things are going to work. They're not picking any one. They're taking a couple. I mean, the MyPillow guy, you know, they... They don't think that's...
Is he calling
know, the,
you again, Henry?
I
told him not to call you anymore.
No, he's on the board of this Texas Biotech or something, and so they're keeping him busy, and he's been on cable TV defending the drug, and not very effectively.
I saw him. No, he was pretty bad. Pretty bad.
Right. And you know, he just kept repeating himself and saying, it'll work. And I say, well, yeah, you sell pillows. You don't do anything with drugs. I mean, how do you know it works? And how does it work? And da-da-da-da. Oh, it works. You know, they tested it in humans, and it's fine in humans, and it's in these cancer trials. And, you know, he sounds a lot like Trump saying, well, you know, the hydroxychloroquine works well with malaria, and it's been around for years, and so there's no problem with using it on coronaviruses. And you know, that you know, it's really in apples and oranges. So, you know, the scientists are kind of thinking, you know, just the way I presented it, that there's a lot of drugs out there. Some of them are going to work, but it's going to take time, and they don't know which combination is going to work. They can look at things like the vaccines and say, well, some of these lead ones that require two injections, you know, may be ready first because they got, you know, further along on their trials, but they probably won't end up, you know, being the vaccine of choice because it takes two injections, and that, you know, that's not a good combination, especially when the pandemic is raging.
Nobody wants two. They don't want one. You
would rather, you know, get. If it did need to, you'd rather be doing it when it falls into some type of seasonal pattern. You can get it when there's not much virus circulating to get ready for the upcoming season, as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, take one dose and worry that while you're making antibodies against the vaccine, you get infected with the virus, and then you don't do that well against the virus because you're busy making antibodies against the spike protein that's in the vaccine, and you're targeting that, and then you get kind of overwhelmed because you've got too many targets. And you know, speaking of too many targets, that is one of the reasons that there is this type of concern about the younger age students, you know, because they do better and they don't die, and that's because they've got a nice, young, active immune system.
Sure.
And the problem is that a lot of these collateral damage, like from cytokine storms, is due to a very active immune system, so that you basically can produce enough different biologically active molecules that will destroy the virus, but the response is so robust that there's collateral damage, and they can destroy some cell types that the virus is in. And then if the virus has this polybasic cleavage site, so it can go into a bunch of different cell types, you can end up with, you know, this heart damage, or you can end up with some neurological issues. And so you may, you know, win the battle, but kind of lose the war, in the sense that you got rid of the virus, but now you've got this debilitating disease that you know, your lung capacity isn't what it used to be, or your heart is more susceptible to problems down the road. And so you can end up, you know, surviving the pandemic, but then
Your quality of life and your longevity is shortened.
Right.
In all likelihood.
You can have all kind of compromises on your health. And that's why, you know, this big experiment saying, you know, it's not a problem. You know, the number of deaths in children is just a tiny percentage. You know, the neighborhood of how many die in flu. That, you know, you can have, on a bad flu season, you can have a couple hundred people, a couple hundred children dying in a full flu season, or a couple hundreds actually on the high side. And this is in the same ballpark, but it's not really the same ballpark because the virus can go to too many different cell types, and it's a brand new virus. And the long-term effects of having an infection with this virus is pretty much unknown. And it's not the type of thing that, you know, you go and you say, well, let's just let it rip and see what happens. They're not going to die. And, you know, we've still got beds in the hospital, and this will work out fine. And then find out that they do have these long-term effects, and they don't know that until a year or two after the fact. And they not, these effects may not be all that reversible. So, in any event, there's still the issue with the schools, and just the Mail update that we kind of touched on yesterday. It doesn't sound like there's an offer to roll back, you know, to replace these orders that have been destroyed.
Right.
So there still will be hearings, and there still will be issues as to how badly that's going to affect the voting.
Very good. We'll
touch on that later.
We'll see. These are uncharted waters, and it's going to get to be pretty crazy. Thank you, Henry.
Yeah.
Get some rest. Okay. We appreciate you. Take care. All righty.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
There he goes. All right. Back with you in 21 hours. That's Thursday night, tomorrow night. Gerald Celente will be here. Back. He was tied up last week. He'll be here tomorrow night. Dr. Eric Carlstrom as well. So that'll be fun. And our nightly report. We're going to keep watching this. It's not going away. Back tomorrow. Take care.